Hi, my name is John Ackerman. This is my second hour discussion of cyclic catastrophism, the alembic of all ancient myth, which tells of the spectacular cosmic encounters of Venus, Mars, and Mercury with the Earth, experienced by the first 100 generations of mankind. In the first hour, I discussed the consistency of the Vedic, Hindu, Egyptian, and Greek myths with a number of biblical verses which have led to the revelation of this heretofore hidden knowledge. Cyclic catastrophism refers to 100 encounters in which Mars was captured in a geostationary orbit close to the Earth for about 15 years and then was released for a comparable period into a planetary orbit of the Sun. Each cycle lasted 30 years, and they continued for 3,000 years from about 3700 to 700 BC. The purpose of these encounters was to rejuvenate a sickly Earth, enabling it to support the large population we have today at the expense of the more ancient, smaller Mars. The enhancements included all the oxygen from Mars' atmosphere, the seeds of tens of thousands of plant species, and roughly a 10% increase in the surface of the oceans from which evaporation of clear water could occur. That is, prior to these 100 encounters, the continental shelves around the world were exposed or above sea level. In this hour, I would first like to discuss the events which triggered cyclic catastrophism, then present the amazing details of the physical effects of Mars and the Earth on one another during the periods when Mars orbited the Earth. The third hour would be devoted to the even more spectacular physical events on Mars, having to do with each of its escapes from orbit, events which no astrophysicist on Earth could anticipate. The encounters with Mars did not just happen. A number of unique one-time events had to take place in preparation for the cyclic encounters which rejuvenated the Earth. To set the stage, the ancient solar system comprised only two terrestrial, that is, rocky planets, Earth and Mars. Both were full of life, probably more robust on Mars, which was in a Venus-like orbit closer to the Sun than the Earth. Based on meteorites from Mars, it is 4.6 billion years old, while the oldest native rocks found on Earth are only 3.9 billion years, a difference of 700 million years. Mars was larger than it is today because it still had its solid iron core, which is now called Mercury. The final separation of the two bodies occurred only 2,700 years ago. One small clue to recent life on Mars within the last 6,000 years is its ancient Egyptian epithet, the Great Green. This translation seems incomplete, but everyone in pharaonic Egypt knew exactly what it meant. The earliest event was the capture of the moon during the Younger Dryas stadial from 12,800 to 11,500 years before the present. God, or the Elohim, placed the moon in orbit to stabilize the orientation of the Earth's rotation. The Greenland ice cores reveal a complete change to a warmer climate immediately after this period. This delineates the beginning of the Holocene era. Moreover, he chose its distance from the Earth to maximize the combined tidal effects of the Sun and the Moon during later alignments with Mars when it orbited the Earth. This is evidenced by total solar eclipses, which are not just coincidence. This is consistent with the Chronicle Project interpretation of Genesis 1:16, which describes Elohim's pairing of the sun and moon. The internal convulsions within Mars resulting from such alignments were the means whereby all of the natural resources were blasted to the Earth over 3,000 years. The next major event occurred around 4000 BC, at which date Proto-Venus was created as the result of an enormously energetic impact on Jupiter. The physical implications of this event alone overturn most major tenets of modern planetary science, answering dozens of questions which astrophysicists secretly puzzle over and sweep under the rug. This in itself merits a major discussion, which I would be happy to give at a future date. Immanuel Velikovsky devoted more than half of his famous book, Worlds in Collision, presenting considerable anecdotal evidence reinforcing the idea that Proto-Venus was born out of Jupiter. But not being a physicist, he never understood the important astrophysical implications. For example, the internal composition of Jupiter, the origin of all terrestrial planets, indeed, the origin of the solar system. One source concerning the creation of Venus was the Greek myth of Pallas Athene, young Athena, said to have been born out of the head of Jupiter. Another was the creation of Aditi from Diospitar in the Rig Veda, in which the initial shape of the plasma cloud which rebounded from Jupiter is claimed to be that of an elephant. For such a shape to have been discerned, the plasma cloud must have been thousands of times the size of the giant planet Jupiter. As discussed previously, the Rig Veda begins with a number of deities called the sons of Aditi, which were all aspects of Proto-Venus as it rampaged through the solar system. The cyclic catastrophism scenario also suggests an extremely rapid reduction of Proto-Venus's orbit, or aphelion, from 5 astronomical units at Jupiter to less than 1 astronomical unit, the orbit of the Earth, in less than 2 centuries. This was due to the transfer of kinetic or orbital energy and intense heating in close encounters with Mars, Earth, and with the Sun at perihelion, in which the partially ionized Proto-Venus at a temperature over 10,000 K was enormously distorted by both electromagnetic and gravitational fields. Proto-Venus had 3 important effects which set the stage for cyclic catastrophism. First, it created large uplifted areas in the rigid outer shells, the crust and mantle of both the Earth, making 2 close passes which completed the uplifting of the Tibetan Himalayan complex, and Mars, with which it had innumerable close encounters, uplifting the Tharsis Bulge and creating the 4,000-kilometer-long fault called Valles Marineris. Secondly, Proto-Venus decimated all hominid life on Earth by scorching and twice overturning the rigid outer shell of the Earth, causing the oceans to flow across entire continents. This resulted in the condition of the Earth described in Genesis 1-2, and the Earth became void and without form. This occurred between 4000 and 3700 BC. Archaeologists call this the end of the Neolithic, the New Stone Age, and the beginning of the Bronze Age I, which, interestingly, was a 300-year silent period from which no archaeological artifacts have been discovered. The purpose was to eliminate the enormous subhuman gene pool, thereby preparing for the introduction of Homo sapiens by the Elohim. Thus, the 300-year Bronze Age I was the time required for the entire Earth to be repopulated by the new Homo sapiens. The third effect of Proto-Venus was that it ejected Mars from its ancient orbit into a planetary orbit which intersected the orbit of the Earth. Note that intersecting orbits cross at two points, and we define points in the Earth's orbit by calendar dates. Velikovsky determined from biblical study that a number of commotions, or rosh in Hebrew, occurred at November 1st and at the vernal equinox, March 20th, but did not understand what these dates really meant. The last encounter of Proto-Venus with Mars occurred relatively close to the Earth. It limited the aphelion of Proto-Venus just short of the Earth's orbit, where it still played an important role in the releases of Mars during the entire cyclic catastrophism period. As a result of its recent creation, Venus's entire interior is molten rock with a thin basalt crust. Lacking any solid core, it has no magnetic field. In fact, the material which will eventually form its Earth-like crust and oceans have not yet settled on the planet because of its great heat. Thus, its correct nomenclature, even today, should be Proto-Venus. The close passes of Proto-Venus created semi-permanent uplifts on the Earth and Mars because their thick outer shells could not recover from the induced tidal distortions. Although the molten interior of Proto-Venus became considerably distorted during each close encounter, these resulted in relatively small permanently uplifted areas on its surface because it settled right back into its spherical shape afterward. In fact, it is the most perfectly spherical planet in the solar system today. So we have Mars and the Earth in intersecting orbits, both with raised anomalous masses on their surfaces. When both the planets approached the Earth's November 1 position, Mars became captured in orbit around the Earth. Biblically, this first encounter was mentioned in Genesis 1, verses 6 and 7, and God made or placed the firmament, the rakia, and God called the firmament heaven. The capture of Mars in orbit answers a number of questions involving quotations cited by Velikovsky in Worlds in Collision. One regards rapid shifts of the sun resulting in a shortening or lengthening of a single day. A and another, the archaeological discovery of calendars with both 360 and 365 and a quarter days per year in many ancient cultures prior to 687 BC. These were a direct result of the capture and release of Mars in a geostationary orbit. Assuming the mass of Mars at the time was the sum of the masses of Mars and Mercury today, the center-to-center distance between the two planets when in geostationary orbit was only 44,000 kilometers. This was only 1/9 of the distance to the Moon. Based on its diameter at the time, Mars appeared some 600 times the area of the full moon. Captures took place every 30 years around the 1st of November, at one point where their planetary orbits crossed, and subsequent releases about 14.4 years later at the vernal equinox, March 20th. In Sanskrit, each period that Mars orbited the Earth was called a kalpa, which was like an eon, and its duration was the Sanskrit word manvantara, which had a duration of 14.4 years. Mars was released at the other crossing point, the vernal equinox. As a result, it spent 15.6 years of R&R in an orbit of the Sun, making the duration of each complete cycle 30 years. In the Hindu religion, which occurred after cyclic catastrophism, the kalpa was enormously inflated to 4.32 billion years because they no longer knew the true nature of the events described in the Rig Veda. Each time Mars was captured, it became tidally locked onto the Tibetan Himalayan complex, recently raised by two close encounters with Proto-Venus. According to the Rig Veda, Indra, which was their name for Mars, remained directly above Mount Kailash. It was termed Indra's home on Earth. This additional inertial mass attached, as it were, to the Himalayas exerted a moment on the outer shell of the Earth, which slowed its rotation to 360 days per year. Even more spectacular, this moment pulled the Tibetan Himalayan complex, that is, only the outer shell of the Earth, south some 30 degrees, where it remained on a temporary equator during each encounter. This resulted in the spin axis of the rigid outer shell of the Earth to move 30 degrees to Hudson Bay. Upon each release of Mars, the Earth reverted to its normal rotation, 365 and a quarter days per year, with the spin axis returning to the current North Pole. These reorientations were possible because the outer shell is isolated from the solid iron core by the low viscosity outer core several thousand kilometers thick. Thus, the capture of Mars accounts for the dual calendars of 360 and 365 and a quarter days per year found in many cultures, for instance, in the Egyptian cultures. The best known calendar being the circular Aztec calendar, which shows 360 days with 5 added or bad days inserted within the ring. This also explains the transient shortening or lengthening of a single day in legends, caused not only by the change in latitude, but also any longitudinal adjustment needed to align Mount Kailash with the approaching Mars. Amazingly, the best historical record of such events is in the Bible. In Isaiah 38:8, it says, "Behold, I will bring again the shadow of the degrees which has gone down in the sundial of Ahaz 10 degrees backward, so the sun returned 10 degrees by which degrees it was gone down." This little gem of a verse cites a pair of changes due to a capture 14.4 years prior and a release of Mars, both in a single verse, given as a sign by the Lord to Hezekiah. Velikovsky writes that rabbinical sources state in a definite manner that the disturbance in the movement of the sun happened on the evening of the destruction of Sennacherib's army by a devouring blast. He also determined that several rosh or commotions took place every, and I quote him, every 14 to 16 years. That was around 700 BC, which he believed were due to close passes of Mars, but never imagined that it actually orbited the Earth. Obviously, he failed to detect an exact interval because of the difference in the duration of the capture and release periods, that is 14.4 versus 15.6 years. Velikovsky cites a number of ancient texts in connection with the apparent shifts of the heavens. For example, that at one time the Great Bear was the pole star, which is possible in the cyclic catastrophism scenario because one of its stars, Dubhe, is close to 30 degrees from the current pole star Polaris, matching the 30 degrees that would have been required to place Mount Kailash on the temporary equator. Also, upon each capture, the tidal effect of Mars drew much of the water in the eastern hemisphere towards the Tibetan Himalayan complex, completely inundating northern India, cutting it off from the southern part of the Indian continent by the tidal bulge several hundred kilometers wide. Geological evidence of these sudden floods towards the Himalayas are recorded in the Siwalik deposits, currently thought to be 25 million years old. These are in the Himalayan foothills up to an elevation of 5,000 feet. These contain the remains of animal species with habitats covering the entire range of elevations from sea level up to a mile high. These sudden 1 or 2 day floods, due to the capture of Mars every 30 years, completely emptied the Mediterranean and Red Seas, probably all bodies of water at similar distances from Mount Kailash, for example, the North Sea, the Baltic Sea, and the Sea of Japan. And they stayed empty for 14.4 years. These transient floods were the reason why all Middle Eastern cultures built pyramids, ziggurats, and cities on flat-topped hills called tells. The Acropolis in Athens served the same purpose, and many high points in the area are called Acropoli. These locations or structures acted as life rafts, which were also earthquake-proof, because the captures of Mars cause simultaneously global earthquakes due to its widespread tidal effects on the Earth's crust. This answers another old question concerning the long-term motivation of the Egyptian people for building the pyramids. It was to save their lives and those of their families and offspring. It's funny that no credit is ever given to the cultures which leveled off the tops of the many jebels, the Arabic word for natural hills, to form the tells. Corroboration of the Mediterranean being repeatedly emptied is provided by many layers of evaporites on its bottom. These are salts. They're called the M layer, formed by the evaporation of the small amount of water remaining during each 14-year period in which Mars orbited the Earth. Geologists have labeled these many mysterious layers of salt the Messinian salinity crisis, implying their age is 5 to 7 million years, because they believe that many natural evaporations of the entire Mediterranean Sea must have required that great span of time. Further corroboration of cyclic catastrophism is given by the discovery of the presence of a deep buried gorge due to the Nile cascading into the empty Mediterranean basin in the recent geological past. Cyclic catastrophism also reveals the purpose of the heretofore mysterious Sphinx, the Greek name which provides no helpful information. However, its Egyptian name is literally Haris am-Akit, which means Haris on the horizon. It faces the position of Mars, which the Egyptians called Haris, which remained stationary in the eastern sky above Mount Kailash for 14 years at a time. In spite of its obvious name, modern Egyptologists do not understand its significance in their cultural history. Each time Mars was released from its Earth orbit, the 5,000-foot high tidal bulge centered at Mount Kailash was suddenly released, catastrophically deepening the five major river gorges through the Himalayas, all of which originate close to Mount Kailash. At each capture of Mars, its drawing of the Himalayas, the outer shell, southward to a temporary equator resulted in the pole, the spin axis of the Earth, moving to Hudson Bay. Assuming Mars' orbit was in the plane of the solar system, the pole would have remained normal to this plane, and there would have been little or no seasonal changes during the 14.4-year Mars encounters. As a result, snow accumulation would have been centered at Hudson Bay for the entire orbital period. During each absence of Mars, the Earth reverted to regular seasons. But it is questionable whether the glacier would have had a chance to melt before the next encounter. It is well-established fact that an enormous continental glacier called the Laurentide Ice Sheet, estimated to have been 9,000 feet high, which was centered at Hudson Bay, covered most of Canada and part of the northern states of the U.S. Geologists cannot explain why this enormous glacier was not centered at the North Pole. Further corroboration of cyclic catastrophism comes from the fact that the west coast of Hudson Bay is still rising at a rate of a meter per century. due to isostatic recovery of the land from this enormous weight. Geologists imagined that this enormous glacier was part of the last ice age, which ended 11,500 years ago. But the standard time always assumed for complete isostatic recovery has always been 10,000 years. So now they have to explain why Hudson Bay is still rising so fast. This has forced them to invoke an unproven phenomenon called delayed isostatic recovery. From a global perspective, the water drawn by Mars formed a stationary tidal bulge 5,000 feet high surrounding the Tibetan Himalayan complex during each 14.4-year encounter. If Mars' orbit was not geostationary, a 5,000-foot-high tide sweeping around the Earth would have killed all life on our planet. So a stationary tide was necessary for conservation of energy and stability on both planets, as I will explain. On Mars, the fixed tide was accomplished in a completely different way than on Earth. Just as the Tibetan Himalayan mass anomaly influenced the Earth's rotation, the proportionally larger mass anomaly or distortion on the equator of Mars, the Tharsis Bulge, played a crucial role in its rotation. This feature was consistent with the Vedic deity for Mars, Indra, being described as an ugly child, and similarly, its Egyptian epithet, the dog-faced star, and the Welsh Arianrhod, the humped silver wheel, also called the Oar Wheel, which, along with the shape of the head of Anubis, emphasized Mars' striking asymmetry. The tidal effect of the Earth on the equatorial Tharsis Bulge prevented its rotation as we would normally think of a planet with its north pole at the top and its south pole at the bottom, as seen from the Earth. In order to maintain the angular momentum or rotational energy of the outer shell of Mars, its spin axis became reoriented towards the Earth. In this orientation, the Tharsis Bulge acted as a spinning top, with the tidal force of the Earth acting as gravity does on a toy top, causing it to seemingly defy gravity by remaining upright as a result of its spinning. So, as Mars approached the Earth, the spin axis of its rigid outer shell, its north pole, was forced to remain oriented towards the Earth. This was possible, similar to the case of Earth's changed rotation axis, by the fact that Mars' low viscosity outer core, several thousand kilometers thick, acted as a low friction bearing, allowing the independent rotation of its outer shell and its solid core. This orientation allowed a permanent tidal bulge on Mars surrounding its north pole, which remained facing the Earth, thereby making the configuration of the two planets stable. No astrophysicist in the world has ever imagined that this could happen, but many myths of the ancient world describing Mars as a slowly revolving wheel, churn, or mill make it quite clear. This reorienting of the spin axis only acted on the rigid outer shell of Mars because that was the position of the mass anomaly. It did not affect the rotation or orientation of its solid core or its magnetic field, which remained the primary source of stability of the planet. The secondary stability was derived by the spin of the distended, rigid outer shell resembling the great wheel. Some myths apply that Mars' slow rotation involved a wobbling or nutation of the secondary spin axis. This was not immediately obvious, since each rotation took about a day. Such a motion nutation has been experienced in the development of communication satellites with a similar design called dual-axis spin-stabilized. In these, the nutation has to be actively controlled for pinpoint accuracy. Of course, the engineers who developed these satellites have no idea that a slightly larger satellite, Mars, beat them to this design. I mentioned Arianrhod. This was the Welsh goddess of the wheeling stars. These stars are the counterpart of the circumpolar stars in other cultures, and the Egyptian deity Apt, called the mother of movement in a circle and the mother of the starry revolutions or cycles of time. These were not conventional stars. These were the many blazing volcanoes in the northern hemisphere of Mars, enhanced by the tidal effect of the Earth. There were so many volcanoes that in the Vedic and Hindu myths, they actually named 27 well-known asterisms or nakshatras. These were constellations of the many volcanoes on the surface of Mars. More volcano stars could be seen on its dark side, the portion not illuminated by the sun. Arianrhod's realm was called Kher Sidi, which means revolving castle. Kher Sidi is depicted in myth as a great turning island surrounded by sea and located in the north, around which the heavens swirl. This feature is still visible at the North Pole of Mars, standing 3 kilometers above the surrounding terrain, crowned with the northern ice cap. Many cultures believe that the souls of the deceased ascended to the northern island when Mars was in the heavens, called the Duat in Egyptian myth, and that each time Mars was subsequently released from its geostationary orbit, it would transport the souls to the gods, to the stars. This was also believed to be the role of Arianrhod, nurturing their journeys between lives. The same function was attributed to Yama-Yami in the Vedas and to Horus in Egyptian myth. Because Mars was recaptured around November 1st, the Egyptians held seances at that date in order to contact the spirits that had been carried away on Mars during previous visits. This custom remains with us today in the form of All Saints' Day and Halloween around November 1st. There were 7 extra-large volcanoes in the northern hemisphere of Mars, the plumes of which rose hundreds of kilometers extending down towards the Earth. Aided by the tidal force of the Earth, these wavered like erect cobras in the Martian winds. They had special names in all cultures. Their Egyptian names were the 7 Uraeus deities. The Vedic name was the 7 holy rishis. Rishis were priests. The Greek 7 sisters of Zeus, and the Japanese Subaru. It is difficult for people in the modern world to imagine how Mars appeared as it orbited the Earth. It was about 6 Earth radii above the Himalayas and was more than half the diameter of the Earth. Most difficult, it remained stationary in the heavens, very slowly rotating like a great wheel, approximately once a day. As it revolved, along with the Earth, it passed through phases like the Moon due to the Sun's illumination changing, but reflected some 600 times more light than the Moon. In North America, it appeared low on the northern horizon because it was directly above Mount Kailash, but high on the opposite side of the Earth. Amerind legends tell of a great warrior that shot an arrow which stuck in heaven, revealing the great age of their cultures, along with the fidelity with which they have been able to pass down their sacred myths through many generations. As mentioned, the orientation of Mars' north pole towards the Earth resulted in all the water in its northern hemisphere to immediately be drawn toward its north pole upon each capture in orbit. One of the first features imaged on Mars by the NASA Mariner probe were enormous outflow channels made by massive volumes of water flowing from the mid-latitudes towards the north, which were due to the tidal effect of the Earth. The resulting Northern Ocean, or Oceanus Borealis, was the Egyptian Nun, the deity from or through which all the familiar deities arose during each visit. Initially, the Northern Ocean acted as a large convex mirror in which the people on the Earth could see a small color image of the Earth against the black background of space. This was the origin of an old-fashioned practice called scrying or mirror gazing, which some believed was a portal into the spirit realm, there communicating with departed loved ones. On a slower time scale, the Earth's tidal effect reduced pressure, causing the subsurface rock at the North Pole of Mars to melt, and once mobile, to be drawn upward through cracks and appear on the bottom of the Northern Ocean, where it could be seen in the water as the golden or glowing world egg. The egg eventually expanded above the ocean at the North Pole early in each encounter. Both the Vedic and the Egyptian texts celebrated this first appearance of the land, which in Egypt marked the end of the first time, or Zeptepi. But Egyptologists do not understand that all the events described in the ancient texts were repeated every 30 years, and so the first time was repeated for every generation to observe and experience. The land which rose at the North Pole was the Egyptian Ta Tenen, the risen land, which became the Duat, Horus's sacred land. Both cultures designated each 14.4-year visit, the Vedic Kalpa, by the name of the familiar animal whose shape the newly appeared land resembled. These were originally called the avatars of Purusha in the Vedas, reincarnations of Brahma, and later the avatars of Vishnu in ancient myth. For example, the tortoise, the fish, and the boar. Similarly, the Egyptians likened the initial shape of this risen land to the water animals familiar to them, the crocodile Sebak or the hippopotamus Taweret. Thus, cyclic catastrophism reveals the origin of another word commonly used today. But having the water in Mars' northern hemisphere displaced to its north pole, nearest Earth, was not sufficient to transfer it to our planet, which was the whole purpose of the encounters. This only occurred when the Moon passed through alignments with Mars. The best wizards, astronomers, of those times worked tirelessly to predict the outcomes of each alignment. The closer the Moon passed to the center of Mars, a disk behind Mars, during the alignments, the stronger were the convulsions induced within the planet. These caused the larger volcanoes to blast huge rocky bodies as large as 20 kilometers in size from its interior into space, and along with them, surface rocks, water, atmospheric gases, and vegetable matter. This is described in the following myth. As Shiva was seated on the Himalayas, where he had been engaged in austerities, Uma, attended by her companion and dressed as an ascetic, came behind him and playfully placed her hands over his eyes. The effect was tremendous. Suddenly, the world became dark, lifeless, and destitute of oblations. The gloom, however, is suddenly dispelled. A great flame burst from Mahadeva, that's Shiva's forehead, in which a third eye, luminous as the sun, was formed. By fire from this eye, the mountain was scorched, and everything on it was consumed. Uma hereupon stands in a submissive attitude before her husband. The explanation of this is that Shiva was the Hindu deity associated with the destructive aspects of Mars. The Hindus called the Tharsis Bulge the face of Shiva. Actually, the Egyptians called the same feature the face of Horus. If you go to my cycliccatastrophism.org and search for the face of Horus, you can see an actual picture of this taken by NASA. Olympus Mons, the largest volcano on Mars, appears to be in the forehead of Shiva's face. This myth describes an alignment of the moon, Uma, passing behind, that is, through an alignment with Mars. The placing of her hands over Shiva's face was due to the convulsions beginning within Mars, which first raised dust, obscuring all his features. Then the enormous convulsion blasts flame and rocks from Olympus Mons. Uma standing by submissively means the moon had passed through the alignment and then is seen adjacent to Mars. At times, when the sun and moon simultaneously passed through alignment with Mars, the convulsions became disastrous. Thus, the ancient fear of eclipses, which we imagine superstition today, had a very powerful physical basis, being times of great danger for everyone on Earth. I have a blog post titled Malignant Aspects of the Sun and Moon, which is the name of one chapter in a Hindu astronomy text, the Surya Siddhanta, which describes the effects of different alignments. The Rig Veda originated from the Aryan lands, which were the closest culture to Mount Kailash, thereby experiencing many more dangerous patas, the Sanskrit word for falls of meteorites from Mars, than, say, the Egyptians. The Rig Veda describes three of Indra's adjunct deities by which it affected the earth, the Vayu, the Maruts, and Parjanya. Vayu was a form of wind whose chariot could be seen touching the top of the earth's atmosphere, carrying rain, soma, odors, and red dust, making everything ruddy. The Maruts were described as youthful warriors, geniuses of the thunderstorm. Their ejections from Martian volcanoes appeared as cinders being expelled from burning logs, but when they crashed to earth, they were potent and powerful. The Maruts were closely associated with Parjanya, or the thunderbolt deity. These were not mere lightning, because they were responsible for breaking up the glaciers in the Himalayas. Velikovsky quotes an ancient myth which claims that when the Himalayas were unstable, the strike of a single thunderbolt could cause an entire mountain range to disappear into the earth and another being thrust upward instantaneously. These resulted from large, glowing, hot rocks falling at high velocities, creating an ionized path which short-circuited the ionosphere of the earth, resulting in a sudden, enormous electrical discharge and a downward blast. Actually, when Ronald Reagan's Star Wars was proposed, concerns were voiced that an X-ray laser directed from space to the Earth might cause exactly the same disastrous effect. It is difficult to believe that more generations of humans lived with these spectacular events occurring in the heavens than have lived since. In Genesis 1, Elohim's placement of the firmament coincides with the creation of Adam, indicating that the rejuvenation of the earth began at the inception of mankind. At that time, rural cultures were better able to cope with the attendant thunderbolts, earthquakes, floods, and displacement of the North Pole, which, if they occurred in modern times, would destroy civilization as we know it. The Vedas occasionally reveal a more human attitude toward the sky gods, if begrudgingly. Here's an example. The gang of gamesters, pretending to be godlike and true as the sun, ventures the game time and time again, but the dice will not truckle to the rage of a contestant, however truculent. Even the king must eat humble pie before them. Cyclic catastrophism had a dangerous potential for global floods and possible nuclear winters. Could every capture be so well timed that Mars passed over the Himalayas at the right time of day? If not, Mars might have come closer than the ideal distance, or it may have approached the Earth at the wrong time. Oceans could have flowed across entire continents, or clouds from every volcano on the Earth could have darkened the sky for 40 years. With the possible exception of the intoxicating soma, or manna, most people living during the period of cyclic catastrophism probably did not realize the positive effects of the encounters with Mars, because they were kept too busy in just coping with a myriad of immediate problems that we can only imagine. Each time Mars was released and the oceans slowly returned to normal, would anyone have noticed that the sea level had increased by 1.5 meters? One exception, the Indo-Iranian Avesta, wisely states that Haoma, or manna, brought the seeds of tens of thousands of plant species to the earth. In spite of the dangers, most cultures preferred the periods when the gods were present to the boring times between visits. But the really big event, the release of Mars from each orbit, was like the 4th of July fireworks times a thousand. Remember when you and your family sat out in the park to watch fireworks, and sometimes, if the wind changed, parts of the rocket casings would fall around you? Well, everyone in the world watched the events associated with each release of Mars. But the stuff falling around you was not cardboard, it was red-hot rocks. At the same time, the enormous water bulge around the Himalayas would flood back to its normal levels around the world as the spin axis of the Earth reverted to its current position. These spectacular events, several of which produced the Lord's most spectacular miracles, will be the subject of my next discussion.